Can I just say how fantastic it is to see so many families in the church? Next to inviting Jesus Christ into your life as your Lord and Saviour, one of the most wonderful things you can do for the kingdom is invite him into your parenting as you raise your children. It seems at times that it is like a draining one-way transaction, but those efforts are not in vain. The children do grow up, and that seed that you've sown becomes a wonderful fruit. It's not in vain, although it sometimes feels like it. Who's right and does it matter? Genesis, quite a contentious area. Who amongst the young children can tell me the name of that dinosaur? T-Rex. In fact, you're right. It's a representation of a T-Rex. Now, here's a question for everyone. Did mankind and dinosaurs live together? Let's have a look. Who thinks no, they did not ever live together? Yep. Okay. Who thinks yes, they once lived together? And who's unsure? It's a bit stacked. The answer you give to that testimony really depends on the testimony you accept. Let me illustrate that. Genesis 1, 24 to 31. And in verse 24 we have, "And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, and the wild animals, each according to its kind." That's verse 24. In that same section, "Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." And concluding that section, "God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day." So dinosaurs were land-dwelling animals. So according to verse 24, on what day did God make them? Day six, yep. And according to verse 26, on which day did God make mankind? Sixth. So a straightforward reading of the Genesis account would say that mankind and dinosaurs once lived together. Why is there so much division on this point in our society? Well, there's a conflict of testimonies. God testifies in his word that mankind and dinosaurs once lived together. The world testifies that dinosaurs were extinct long before mankind existed. This is actually an example of a much larger conflict between God's word and the world. If we accept God's testimony, we have to reject the world's testimony, and vice versa. Let's have a look at the implications of that. If we reject Genesis' history, the following logically come from that. Death, and by that I mean physical death. Physical death came before sin, because the fossil record shows evidence of death, disease, and suffering. So if you believe that that's the process by which creation was accomplished, and mankind comes at the end of that process, then death was in the world before mankind could have ever sinned, whatever sinning was. And it calls into question God's character. Why? Because again, if you look at that fossil record and say that's the process by which God created the universe, and we came at the end of that fossil record, and that fossil record has death, disease, and suffering, when God says it is very good, at the end of Genesis, he is saying death, disease, and suffering are very good. I don't know anyone that believes that. So then the question is, what does God consider to be good? And it also follows the Bible can't be completely trusted. Genesis, which is written as a historical narrative, i.e. real history, cannot be read as real history. So then it follows, when can I trust the Bible when it's a historical narrative? Can I trust the Gospels, which purport to be eyewitness accounts, reliable eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life on earth? So that's the fruit of rejecting Genesis. Death before sin, the character of God is questioned, and the Bible cannot be completely trusted. But, and there is always a but with God, if we accept Genesis, death is the result of sin. God created a world without death, disease, and suffering. Mankind sinned, and that introduced death. The character of God is unquestionably good, because a straightforward reading of Genesis says there was no death, disease, or suffering. And God calls that very good, which is exactly what most of us would say is very good. And lastly, it follows that the Bible can be trusted. Because if Genesis, and particularly the first few chapters of Genesis, is literal history, and that is the most hotly contested area in our Bible, if that is true and we can trust it there, then we can logically trust it anywhere where it speaks as real history. So the question comes, why is the world's testimony about origins so at odds with the Bible's testimony about origin? And in a word, it's science. Now, science in this instance means something quite specific. It's a method to understand the physical and natural world through observation and experiment. It's a tool. So is it a case that science has proved the world's testimony about origins? Is it a case that it's done that? Well, science can prove... What do you think? What can science prove? Nothing. The scientific method doesn't allow you to prove things. In fact, science can only disprove, or we sometimes use the word falsify. So, it then follows is it a case that science has disproved the Bible's testimony about origins? And that is where most of us are in society today. We have that question hanging over us. If you're anything like me and you hold to Genesis as real history, it is really challenging in our society, because you are in a minority position. And not just in society, but in many churches you will be in a minority position. When you're in a minority position, you constantly question yourself, am I wrong in my beliefs? I want to encourage you today that you can indeed take Genesis as real history. I'm going to do that by looking at three big conflicts between the world's testimony about origins and the Bible's testimony about origins. And as we look at each of these conflicts, I want you to answer just one question, just one for each conflict. Is this science versus faith, or is this faith versus faith? In particular, the faith of naturalism versus biblical faith. Now, naturalism is a philosophy, and it is right through modern science. And it says you can only explain things by natural processes. You cannot involve the divine. Now, if you think about that for a minute, that's an assumption. And so in that sense, naturalism is a religion. In fact, I would say it's the main religion in Australia today. Well, let's have a look at the first of these conflicts. The earth is very old. In fact, the age currently put on the earth is 4.5 billion years. Well, that certainly contradicts the Bible's account of origins. A straightforward reading of the Bible would have the earth at about 6,000 years or so. Is it a case here that science has disproved what the Bible is claiming to be true? Welcome to the dating game. Question for you. Can you date anything by simply examining it in the present? Who thinks you can? I'll make this a little bit more specific for you. And the children can join in on this. How old am I?
Old.
Let's put a number on it. Let's be engineers and quantify that. How old am I? Now you've got to tell me, how old do you think I am? 62, 68? How old? 30? Wow, I'll take yours, banked. There's some interesting guesses there, but I can tell you now, they're all wrong. I can say with certainty that I'm 61 years, 6 months, and 22 days old. How on earth do I know that? I have a birth certificate, a reliable eyewitness record of the time of my birth. In fact, the Australian government regards it as definitive. You see, there is nothing that you could do to me in the present, no measurement you could take that would directly tell you my age. You could infer an age, but you'd have to make assumptions, and you don't know those assumptions are right. In fact, a reliable eyewitness record is the only way to date anything with certainty. Now, the gold standard today in dating, the one that science uses, and that is where the 4.5 billion years comes from, is radioactive dating. It's a technical area, but basically there are some atoms, and we'll call them parent atoms, and they break down and they form different atoms, and we'll call them daughter atoms, and that process is radioactive decay. And that is the process that they use to date rocks to end up with 4.5 billion years. Now, I'm going to illustrate this with a much older timekeeping device. What's this? Yeah, an hourglass or a sand glass. Now, if I showed you a picture of that particular hourglass and I told you as that was supplied, it was a 5-minute timer, 5 minutes, and about half the sand is in the top and half the sand is in the bottom, how long ago did I turn it over? 2.5 minutes. That's a very reasonable guess, but it is a guess. Why? You made some assumptions, didn't you? You made the assumption that all the sand was in the top and none was in the bottom, and you don't know that. You made a second assumption. Half the sand has moved, half the time has elapsed. You've actually assumed the rate of movement from one chamber to another is uniform, and you don't know that. And you made one other assumption, which isn't so obvious. You've assumed that I haven't added sand to either chamber or taken it out. Radioactive dating's a lot like that. You can think of the stuff in the top as the parent atoms, the sand in the bottom as the daughter atoms, and that process of moving from one chamber to another as decay. In fact, I could have just done that, and you would be no wiser. If I take meteorites, which is where that 4.5 billion years comes from, it's not Earth rocks, they're rocks from space. If I take those meteorites and I analyse the amount of parent atoms in them, and the amount of daughter atoms in them, and I measure the present day decay rate, does that tell me how old that meteorite is? No, it doesn't. It tells me the concentration of the parent atoms, concentration of daughter atoms, present day decay rate. To infer an age, I have to start making assumptions, the same ones we've just talked about. If I make assumptions that are favourable to deep time, I'll get deep time. If I make assumptions that are favourable to biblical time frames, I'll get a biblical time frame. You get the answer that follows from the assumptions you make. So when we believe that a meteorite is 4.5 billion years old, we have to believe the things that we've assumed are true. What is it when we believe something to be true but cannot prove it? What's it called? Yep, should all get that right because we're Christians. We believe by faith. You see, conflict one is not science versus faith. It is, in fact, faith versus faith. The faith of naturalism versus biblical faith. Conflict two. The claim from the world's testimony of origins is this. Life emerged spontaneously from non-life in the distant past and microbes were transformed into mankind over time by biological evolution. That is the world's testimony about origins. Well, that certainly contradicts what we just read. It's very clear that God created life. He created it according to certain kinds and each kind produces more of the same kinds. So it is a case here that science has disproved the Bible's testimony about origins. Let's have a look at something. The law of biogenesis. So this was actually proposed by a German scientist in the 1850s, but it was actually demonstrated by a French scientist, Louis Pasteur, experimentally. And it essentially says, life produces life, each according to its own kind. That is fully consistent with Genesis. And Pasteur did that work to debunk something. It was to disprove spontaneous generation. See, at the time, this is the 1850s, it wasn't a biblical view, but there was a lot of people that believed life came from non-life. And Pasteur was able to debunk that experimentally. Now, the plus 150 years since that law was proposed, we have never observed any exception to it. Well, that challenges spontaneous generation, doesn't it? Let's look a little bit more closely at something. Question for you. And again, the kids can jump in on this one. We'll see which get it right. If I took the simplest microbe known to mankind, the simplest, rock bottom, and I took a modern city and I asked you, which is more complex, what would your answer be? City? That's a logical answer. I mean, we sit there and we look at a modern city and it's got a huge amount of infrastructure in it. It's got transport systems. It's got communication systems. It's got control systems. There are people to operate and maintain that city. It has power plants to power it. It has factories to make things. If you pick the modern city, and that's entirely understandable, you would in fact be wrong. The simplest microbe is more complex because it can do all of that and make a copy of itself in 20 minutes. Why don't you think about this for a minute? Just think about what I'm about to say to you. Does this make sense? An archaeologist discovers the remains of a city and concludes that it is the product of intelligence, not time and chance. Somebody built the city. Reasonable? But a microbiologist examining a microbe concludes that it is the product of what? Time and chance and not intelligence. Do you see the contradictory thinking there? Modern science is full of thinking like that because of its silo structures. People work in particular areas, and because the framework they're using is naturalistic. It reminds me of a verse in Romans. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but in their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. I see that increasingly in modern science. So how complex is the simple microbe? No one knows for sure exactly how many systems have to be in place for it to exist. As many as 2 million have been suggested. That is, 2 million independent systems have to be in place and working for that microbe to come into existence. The simplest microbe. The simple microbe is irreducibly complex. And irreducible complexity cries out design and designer. What's the source of all this complexity that we see in the world today? Well, it's really information. Now, let's take that simple microbe. It has, and I've rounded this for simplicity's sake, it has about 500,000 base pairs on its DNA. You can think of that as letters of code, and they code for everything that microbe needs to function. So about 500,000 letters of code. We, on the other hand, mankind, have about 3,000 million base pairs on our DNA. That is a lot more code because we have got a lot more features to code for. So, if you believe that biological evolution transformed microbes into mankind, you have to believe that a 6,000-fold increase in the information content was possible. Does that sound right? Let's take a look at something. Who can tell me what SETI stands for? Does anyone know what SETI stands for? Yeah, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So 1990s, governments around the world poured billions of dollars, and some private individuals poured billions of dollars into looking for what? Little green men, yes. Now, we don't have spacecraft capable of doing that journey through interstellar space at this point. But we do have lots of radio telescopes. And so we can listen to the radio waves from the universe. So a search for extraterrestrial intelligence was done using radio waves. Now, we can tell the difference between information and noise. Okay? So the premise was the creation of new information is the product of intelligence, not the product of time and chance. Right. If they had found information in those radio waves, it would have been broadcast loud and wide, we found evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence. What did they find? Nada. Nothing. SETI died a quiet death. Now, consider this, and I want you to ask yourself, does this ring true? An astronomer scanning the universe with a radio telescope believes the creation of new information is the product of intelligence, not time and chance. But a biologist studying the evolution of microbes to mankind includes the creation of new information is the product of time and chance, not intelligence. It's more of that contradictory thinking that I see in science today. How about some amazing faith? We're Christians, we believe in faith. You want to see some real faith? You're about to see it. To believe, claim two, that science has disproved the Bible's testimony about the origins of life, to believe that that's true, you have to believe the following. Abiogenesis. That's not biogenesis. You have to believe life from non-life, something that's never been observed or demonstrated. You have to believe irreducible complexity arose by time and chance, not design, something that's never been observed or demonstrated. And you have to believe a vast increase in new information was the product of time and chance and not intelligence. You have to believe all of those things, but you don't know any of them to be true, to believe that science has disproved the Bible's account of origins. What is it when we believe something is true but cannot prove it? Faith? Yep. Conflict two is not science versus faith. It is, in fact, faith versus faith, the faith of naturalism versus biblical faith. And I hesitated with conflict three. Conflict three was actually my most difficult issue after I became a Christian. And sometimes we choose not to speak into it because it's quite a technical area, but I've chosen to do that. So let's see how we go. Conflict three, and I think some of you will have heard this argument. The universe is vast and we can observe objects far too distant from Earth for the biblical time frame. Is it a case here that science has disproved the Bible's testimony about the origins? Here's some information from background. Astronomy is the science that observes the physical universe. That's looking at it, whether that be by optical telescopes or by radio telescopes. Cosmology is the science that seeks to explain the origins of what we see in astronomy. And an important observation from astronomy: in whichever direction we look, the universe looks roughly the same. Doesn't matter whether you look from the North Pole, South Pole, from the equator, it looks roughly the same. Now, astronomical distances, these are huge. So astronomers have their own measurement of distance. It's called a light year. It's the distance light travels in a vacuum in 1 year. It's a measure of distance, not time. And it's equivalent to about 9.46 times 10 to the 12 kilometres, or 9.46 trillion kilometres. It is a truly staggering distance. Now, we can measure distances to objects in space directly up to about 10,000 light years away. But beyond that, we have to infer those distances. So we measure other things and infer the distance, and we use the luminosity and redshift for that. Now, celestial objects are inferred to be millions and billions of light years from Earth. Wow, that's a challenge. What's the implications? Question: how long would it take for light to travel from an object that's a million light years away? How long would it take? You go, in 1 year, you do one light year. So if you're a million light years away, how long has it taken? A million? Yep. Good, see your mass is on target. 1 million years. Question: does this disprove the biblical age of about 6,000 years? Now, you're going to get no prizes for guessing what I'm about to say. What do you think? Here's my answer. No. And you go, Bill, you need your head read. Why would I say that? There are many possible solutions to this apparent conflict, right? But for economy of per time, we're just going to consider two. But you only need one viable explanation to say the biblical account is not disproved. You only need one viable one. The argument on the previous slide makes at least two significant assumptions. There's a universal cosmic clock. Out there somewhere is a cosmic clock ticking, and it applies to the whole universe. And we know the one-way speed of light, and it's the same as the two-way speed of light we've measured. So let's look at those. The passing of time. Question: by whose clock is the 1 million years measured? Whose clock would it be? Our clock? Someone else's clock? It's actually measured by its clock. Okay? Now the question is this. Do all clocks in the universe necessarily tick at the same rate? Answer, no. See, up until the time of Albert Einstein, time was regarded as absolute. A clock here and a clock on Jupiter and a clock at Alpha Centauri would all tick at the same rate. But Einstein discovered something. Time is? Who's heard of that? Time is relative. Yeah. He said, the passage of time is dependent on the observer according to the special and general theories of relativity. Now that sounds a bit whacked, doesn't it? I've got a clock, you've got a clock. They say the same time, don't they? Not quite. You see, we use this physics every day, even though most of you don't realise it. When you use global positioning satellites to find your location, you are depending on that physics being true. Without it, you would be hopelessly lost, because those clocks on those satellites will tick faster than clocks on Earth. And if we don't compensate for that, you're lost. Depending on the assumptions made, it's possible to construct a cosmology in which there are no time dilation effects. Or one, where we have time dilation effects. So we could have a cosmos in which there is a universal clock or no universal clock. Begs the question, if time is relative, what clock is Genesis using? We just read it. Evening and morning, first day. Evening and morning, second day. Evening and morning, third day. Evening and morning, fourth day. On the fourth day, God created the luminaries in the sky to mark the sacred times, days and years. It is an earth-based clock and earth-based time, which makes sense if he's talking to us on Earth. Now, this is where it gets a little tricky. So hopefully, just persevere here. I'm going to give you a couple of cosmologies. That's theories about how the universe came to be. And the first one is the universe is unbounded, i.e. it has no edge or centre. What do we mean by that? I want you to think of the universe as a deflated balloon and little dots on it. And you blow the balloon up. Each dot sees roughly the same number of dots around it, and they're all moving away from it. That's an unbounded universe, okay? It's an assumption. You're making an assumption. So it follows that in that case, there's no privileged position, and the cosmologists call that the cosmological principle. It follows then if the mass distribution is roughly constant across the universe, that clocks would tick at the same rate in a cosmic sense. And it would make sense to speak of a universal cosmic clock and a universal cosmic clock age for the universe. That would all make sense if you make that starting assumption. And that'd be reasonable if you were naturalistic in your thinking, because to have a privileged position would be so implausible, it's not funny. But if you sue a second cosmology, the universe is bounded. So if I'm in a bounded universe, it has an edge and a centre, and whichever direction I look, it looks roughly the same, where must I be? Somewhere near the centre. Yeah, there's a privileged position. Earth would have to be somewhere near the centre. Now, if that's the case, clocks would tick at different rates, because you are close to a very large centre of mass. Your clock will run much, 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 much slower. And that would allow time for light to travel vast distances within a biblical time frame on Earth. And it would not make sense to speak of a universal cosmic clock. And that would make sense from a theistic or God-believing worldview. You see, depending on the assumptions you make in cosmology, light from distant objects can be inconsistent or consistent with a biblical time frame. Just depends on the assumptions you make. The assumptions are largely dictated by your worldview. So if I'm naturalistic in my thinking, I will make assumptions that are naturalistic. If I'm biblical in my biblical thinking, I'll make assumptions that are biblical. I want you to understand one other thing. The Big Bang, which is the secular view of the origins of the universe, has its own light time travel problem. It's called the horizon problem. Do you know how they deal with that? They just invoke a thing called inflation. Nobody knows what inflation is. Well, you do if you're living in Australia at the moment. Nobody knows what inflation is. And its cause for it starting and stopping, they haven't got. They just plug it in there and say, oh, yep, fix that problem. As a believer in the Bible, they would hammer you on that, but they're quite happy to do it themselves. The last one is speed of light. I'll do this very quickly. This is a second possible explanation for being able to see distant objects. I'm not saying either of these is right. I am saying they are plausible alternatives which explain how only a few thousand years here pass and distances and times elsewhere are different. We can accurately measure the two-way speed of light. We've been doing that for over 100 years. The one-way speed of light, I don't know if you realise this, the one-way speed of light has never been successfully measured despite 100 years of attempting to do so. If you could do that, if you could crack that problem, people have been trying this since Einstein. If you could crack that problem, you'd definitely get yourself a Nobel Prize. It's commonly assumed the one-way speed of light is the same as the two-way speed of light that we've measured. In other words, speed of light is synchronous, same both directions, same in and out. And that's what Einstein assumed in his original paper. He said, I know this to be true, but I assume it to be true because it makes the maths easier. However, there is nothing to say it can't be asynchronous. So, let me illustrate. If I took a laser and I fired it at the moon and hit one of the reflectors that were left there by the Apollo astronauts and it bounced back to Earth, I would receive the signal back in about 2.6 seconds. You might assume it took 1.3 seconds to hit the moon and 1.3 seconds to return, but you don't actually know that. You assume that. It could have got to the moon in 2.6 seconds and returned instantly, i.e. it's asynchronous. If the one-way speed of light outwards was half the two-way speed of light and the inward speed of light was infinite, we could see distant objects instantly. That physics stands. We can't prove that to be wrong because we can't measure the one-way speed of light or haven't done so yet. You see, distant starlight is only a problem for a biblical time frame if the following are true, amongst other things. The cosmological principle is correct, and hence there is a universal cosmic clock, so it makes sense to talk of the age of the universe. But we don't know that to be true. And the speed of light is synchronous, and we don't know that to be true. So if you believe that claim three has disproved the Bible's account of, or the Bible's account of origins, you have to believe on those two principles, but you don't know them to be true. So again, when we believe something to be true but can't prove it is called faith. You see, conflict three is not science versus faith, but it is in fact faith, naturalistic faith versus biblical faith. In conclusion, why would I spend my time talking on this stuff? Why would I do that? Well, this is the reason. Accepting the account of origins in Genesis is foundational to the rest of the Bible. Most of your key doctrines are in Genesis 1 to 3. And without this foundation, our belief is inconsistent. What we believe about the Bible is inconsistent, and it is easily shaken. And this is the point I want to encourage you with. There is nothing in science that disproves the account of origins in the Bible, despite what the world claims. So thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions afterwards from any of the congregation. I'll be hanging around the table, so thank you very much.